Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. Learn about a historic Supreme Court decision. Then, hear about a secret of New York City on our weekly science feature, followed by our American history program. But first, this story.
Mas Yamashita does not remember when he and his family left their small home in Oakland, California. But he does remember where they went. The Tan Phuran Assembly Center in San Bruno, California. During World War II, thousands of Japanese Americans were held there while a more permanent center was built. Yamashita, an American born in California, was one of 120,000 people detained in such camps during the war. "Really, my childhood memories began in the camp," Yamashita says. He was 6 years old at the time and is now 82.
The Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, led to United States involvement in World War II. After the attack, President Franklin Roosevelt approved Executive Order 9066. The order resulted in government action against Japanese descendants living on the U.S. West Coast. They were required to leave their homes and move to 10 recently built camps. These camps were in California and six other states: Arizona, Arkansas, Colorado, Idaho, Utah, and Wyoming. To find the descendants, the federal government secretly used information collected in the 1940 U.S. Census. The census is an official count of the population. It is completed every 10 years. The next census will be in 2020. It is illegal to release or use any census information to target a specific population or group. But two researchers found evidence that census officials cooperated with the federal government to find Japanese Americans. The two are Margo Anderson, a historian at the University of Wisconsin, and William Seltzer, a statistician at Fordham University in New York. Their papers showed that census officials released information such as the names and street addresses to the government. David Inoue is head of the Japanese American Citizens League. He told VOA that because of what happened to us, it is now safer to participate in the census without the fear of such action happening again. But Inoue admitted that many people still fear that census records could be used against them.
The Japanese experience has become important to new immigrants after the U.S. Census Bureau proposed adding a citizenship question to the 2020 census form. Asking if someone is a citizen has not been done by the Census Bureau since the 1950s. In addition to collecting information about the population, the census also helps decide the number of representatives each state gets in Congress and how federal money is spent. Critics of a citizenship question say that immigrants will be less likely to answer census questions if they are asked about citizenship. They say this could change how much federal aid their communities get. The Census Bureau agrees. In documents from a 1980 case, census officials said that adding a citizenship question would threaten the accuracy of the population count because immigrant communities would be concerned about how the government will use the information. The Trump administration rejects this belief. U.S. officials say that asking about citizenship will help enforce the Voting Rights Act by confirming who has the right to vote. Tomas Yamashita, a citizenship question would be pretty tragic. You wonder, he asked, why do they want to have that information? More than 70 years later, it is still painful for Yamashita to talk about his experience in detention camps. I lost touch with the children in the camp after we left. I had photographs of friends that I used to play with.
His father wanted him to attend a Japanese school, but instead, he tried to stay away from his Japanese culture. There were a couple of Japanese schools in the city, but I lied because I didn't want to have anything to do with the Japanese, Yamashita said. So I didn't go. To this day, I don't speak Japanese. I can't read or write in Japanese. Most of the people I know my age don't speak or write Japanese. I think we all felt the same way in the sense that we didn't want anything to do with the Japanese culture when we got out, he said. Yamashita remembers having fights in school with students who made fun of him for being different. He also ignored the only other Asian student in his class. I didn't talk to her until we reached high school, he said. Mas Yamashita spent many years working in the advertising industry. Now he volunteers at the Japanese American National Museum to help make up for all the time he avoided the Japanese community. We have to make sure that we record all these stories. We have to keep telling them to future generations. All of my older sisters and brothers are gone, and they never got around to do that, he said. After we got out, nobody ever talked about it. Nobody, he said. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
Now, Supreme Court decisions that changed America.
Brown versus Board of Education is one of the country's most important cases. It overturned an earlier Supreme Court decision, and it helped launch the civil rights movement. At the center of the case was a little girl. In the early 1950s, Linda Brown was 8 years old. Every day, she had to travel for more than an hour to go to a local public school for black children. At the time, public school systems could legally separate black and white students. The reason related to a Supreme Court decision from 1896. It said that separating people by race was legal as long as the buildings and equipment were equal. But the father of young Linda Brown did not think racial segregation was right or fair. He wanted his children to go to the school close to their house, even if the school was for white children. When he tried to register Linda there, school officials said no. so Brown and other activists took action in court against the law. They said schools separated by race could never be equal. All 9 Supreme Court justices agreed. Brown versus Board of Education demanded equal opportunity in public education, and in time led to desegregation in other public places.
Storms and tides are uncovering long-hidden human remains on New York's Heart Island. The island is a place where New Yorkers who have little money when they die have been buried for 150 years. Now, skulls and other bones mark the ground of the small piece of land. Pictures of the remains have appeared in news reports for years. So in late April, forensic anthropologists from the City Medical Examiner's Office visited the island. They collected 174 human bones, which they carefully examined and recorded. Their finds included 6 skulls, 31 leg bones, and many other bones from the head and body. Small red flags marked places along the rocky waterline where remains were found. Carol DiMedio's grandfather, Luigi Roma, was buried on the island. He died of tuberculosis in 1933. DiMedio told the Associated Press, "When I hear about the erosion, I always think, are the bones his? Could any of them be his?" Activists say the bones are a sign that the island has needed improvements for a long time. The United States federal government started a $13.2 million project to repair the erosion that Superstorm Sandy and other storms caused in 2012.
But activists want the government to increase the efforts of that project. They also want Heart Island to be turned into a park and historic location, even as it continues to be used as a burial ground. New York City Council member Mark Levine argues that the people buried there should be respected. "These are New Yorkers," he said. "These are human beings who were largely marginalized and forgotten in life. They were people who died homeless or destitute. And we're victimizing them again in their final resting place." About 1 million people are buried on Heart Island. New York City bought the island in 1868. It went on to use the land for a workhouse for troubled young men and a burial place for the poor. Over the years, Heart Island has housed a Civil War prison, an asylum, a tuberculosis hospital, a jail, and a missile base. All the while, New York continued shipping bodies there that went unclaimed at the city morgue. The Department of Corrections, the city's prison system, has run the island for more than 100 years. But the land has never been kept in as good condition as a traditional burial ground.
Prisoners dig long holes. Adults go in the ground in wooden boxes, placed on top of one another. Babies are placed in small containers. Around 1,000 people are buried there each year. The burials take place in private. Admittance to the island is limited to monthly boat trips that must be requested ahead of time. Only people with loved ones buried on the island are permitted to visit the graves. Others are restricted to a visitor's area close to where boats arrive. In 2012, Superstorm Sandy's floodwaters washed away an embankment, which revealed a water storage system dating back to the American Civil War. More recent storms have also eroded the island. Federal work to repair the erosion is set to begin in 2020. Until then, city officials say an archaeologist will visit at least once a month to remove and bury remains that have been uncovered.
Revealed remains have been a problem before. A March 1985 report by the city's sanitation department found bones spread across the island, including a skull on the beach. Melinda Hunt is an activist and the creator of the Heart Island Project. She has been recording conditions on the island since 1991. On a recent boat trip around the island, she noted the places along its northern side where bones could be seen. They came to clean this up, but it isn't the first time and it won't be the last, said Hunt. Carol DiMedio said she wishes the uncovered bones would be tested for DNA evidence in order to help other families find loved ones. She had done research since she was young to try to find out where her grandfather was buried. When she finally found the answer, she did not want to tell her sick, aging mother where her father had been laid to rest. When I found him, I lied, and I said he was buried in a beautiful place, with blue water and blue skies and lots of trees and green grass, DiMedio said. I didn't have the heart to tell her there's this grim place called Heart Island. I'm Lucia Malonic.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Next is our Making of a Nation program.
Theodore Roosevelt became president at the beginning of the 20th century. It was a time of rapid changes in American society. The changes were a result of technology. Great progress had been made, for example, in transportation. Almost every American city had a street railroad or trolley. These systems were powered by electricity. Thousands of Americans owned automobiles, and Henry Ford was planning a low-cost version which even more people could buy. Great progress had been made in communications. There were telephones in almost every business office in the cities and in many homes. And Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi had sent the first wireless message across the Atlantic Ocean.
It was clear that the United States had made great progress in technology. Yet many believed it had made little progress in social issues. These people felt America's natural resources were being misused. They felt America's farmers were poorer than they should be. They felt America's industries were unfair to workers. Since the late 1800s, a spirit of reform had been growing in the United States. It started among farmers and led to the creation of a new political party, the Populists. Then organized labor joined the movement. Then middle-class Americans. Not everyone agreed on ways to solve society's problems, but they were united in the belief that social progress had to be made. The future of American democracy, they said, depended on the success of the progressive movement. The man who came to represent the spirit of reform most of all was the new president, Theodore Roosevelt.
Roosevelt was born to a wealthy family in New York City in 1858. He was a weak child with poor eyesight. He spent much of his time reading. When Theodore was 13 years old, he got into an argument with two other boys. He tried to fight them, but he was not strong enough. That incident was a turning point in Roosevelt's life. He decided to overcome his physical weaknesses through exercise and hard work. He lifted weights, ran long distances, and learned how to be a boxer. He continued these activities while he attended Harvard University. After college, Roosevelt married Alice Lee and returned to New York. He became active in the Republican Party. When he was just 23 years old, he was elected to the state legislature. Roosevelt quickly became known as a reform politician. He denounced all forms of dishonesty in government.
Roosevelt's first political career did not last long. He withdrew after 4 years, following the deaths of his wife and mother. His sadness was so great that he could not continue. Roosevelt moved to a ranch in the Dakota Territory of the American West. He began to raise beef cattle. At first, the local cowboys laughed at him. They called him Four Eyes because he wore eyeglasses. They stopped laughing when they found he could do the hard work of a cowboy as well as any of them.
Roosevelt spent 2 years in the West. Then he returned to New York and a life in politics. He became the Republican candidate for mayor of New York City, but lost the election. Then he campaigned for Republican Benjamin Harrison in the presidential election of 1888. Harrison won, and he named Roosevelt head of the Federal Civil Service Commission. Roosevelt fought hard to keep politics out of the civil service. Democrat Grover Cleveland was elected president 4 years later. He approved of Roosevelt's civil service reforms. He asked him to remain in the job. Roosevelt did so for another 2 years. Then he became commissioner of police in New York City. Once again, he pushed for reforms. He removed policemen found guilty of receiving illegal payments.
In 1897, President William McKinley named Theodore Roosevelt Assistant Secretary of the Navy. The United States went to war against Spain a year later. Roosevelt wanted an active part in the war, so he resigned and joined the army. He organized a force of horse soldiers known as the Rough Riders. They were honored for bravery in the Battle of San Juan Hill in Cuba. Roosevelt was now a war hero. Republican Party leaders in New York thought he would be the perfect candidate for governor. Teddy, as the public called him, won a close election. He soon made clear he would not take orders from party leaders. The new governor proposed controls on businesses. His main targets were companies that supplied the public with water, electricity, and natural gas. He demanded changes in the food and drug industries, and he shortened the workday for women and children.
The public praised Roosevelt's reform efforts. Local party leaders did not. As one said, "I do not want him raising hell in my state any longer." Local leaders decided the best way to get him out of New York politics was to support him for Vice President of the United States. The office gave a man very little voice or power in politics. Roosevelt did not want the job for that reason. By then, he wanted just one thing, to be President of the United States. He was sure being Vice President would ruin his chances. But he accepted the nomination at the National Convention. He would run on the ticket with William McKinley. "Sadly," he said, "I do not expect to go any further in politics." Several months after he was sworn in as Vice President, he was sworn in as President. William McKinley was dead. Theodore Roosevelt became president as the result of an assassin's bullet.
Roosevelt promised party leaders that he would continue McKinley's policies. He said he would move slowly in making any changes. In his first message to Congress, President Roosevelt offered a few new proposals. He asked for a Department of Commerce and Labor to deal with industrial problems. He called for a stronger navy and for limits on immigration. And he proposed building a canal in Central America to link the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
Businessmen who feared the worst when Roosevelt became president began to breathe easier. It seemed he was not going to push for reforms after all. But Roosevelt was only following an old hunting rule of African tribesmen. "Speak softly," the rule said, "and carry a big stick." Roosevelt spoke softly during his first months as president. He would use the big stick later. When the blow came, it was against big business. A group of wealthy railroad owners had agreed to join their railroads into one. They formed a company to control it. The new company would have complete control of railroad transportation in the American West. There would be no competition.
And that is our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from America and around the world.